Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pulse.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Inkblack Heart, this time covering chapters 48 through 52 of part 3. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Inkblack Heart will occasionally reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series. But of course, before we get started on today's set of chapters, we do have a few important announcements to go over.
We have some freaking out to do before we start, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's our scheduled freakout time now?
Yeah, my alarm just went off for it and everything.
I'm so excited.
Tell us, Lindsay, what's going on?
They announced The Running Grave will be out on September 26th.
Yay!
That's so exciting.
That is the most understated reaction in the history of forever.
At this point, we've had what, a few days to get used to this? I'm still so excited. How many months is that? Not many.
It feels like it's going to be here really, really quickly. I just want to point out again that Sam and I were tied for 2 weeks off. I was Good 2 weeks early. He was 2 weeks late.
That's amazing. My guess had a six in it. So I think
you were in the same month.
I think that also counts.
Sure. I did send Sam a message and I was like, hey, we tied. Virtual high five.
Too bad there's not a prize. Oh, wait, the prize is that we get to read The Running Grave.
That is a good prize. Yeah.
Yep, pretty fucking awesome prize.
And how many pages do we get to read?
912.
Oh, that is so exciting.
What did it start out as? 834?
It was like 832. 832. Uh huh.
Yeah, I kind of expected that to shift a little bit because that's what happened last time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is pretty official, right?
Yeah, it's like that across everything, like on Hachette, on Amazon, everywhere.
Oh, that's so exciting.
Yeah, that's just about, what, 15 pages less than Troubled Blood?
Yeah.
Perfect. Because Troubled Blood was a good size.
It was a great size. Troubled Blood also had all those journal entries, too. So it's pretty much the same.
It did. Unless we get something other like that.
A bunch of I Ching hexagrams and stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can't believe she did all this in a little over a year. Right? What? Or was it a year?
I'm telling you, she must have really enjoyed writing this.
Which is a good sign.
And she did say that she loved writing it.
Yeah.
So in light of getting The Running Graves release date, we are going to have to make some updates to how many chapters we're including per episode.
Yep.
It's going to be, I think, around 5 chapters per episode. So our episodes are going to end up being a little bit longer. And there will probably be a few times this summer where we'll have to release episodes back to back.
Yeah, definitely. It's the only way to make it work.
Yeah, because we're having to kind of cram like 3 months worth of stuff into our remaining time until the end of September.
I'm a little nervous because it's a lot.
Yeah.
But hopefully we can do it. And hopefully it's true that people don't mind the longer episodes. People have said they don't. So we're going to go for it.
Question is if we can survive the longer episodes.
A lot of work, but we'll make it work. I think
we
can do it.
We're willing to make that sacrifice.
Sacrifice. Like it's so much.
Yeah. So difficult.
I have to think about Strike more often. God.
Oh no. So in other slightly less exciting, but still Running Grave related news, Jo did update her Twitter header again. This time she updated it to be a picture of Rupert Court from Chinatown in London, which was exciting. And it's also a location I believe that they used in the Troubled Blood adaptation, right?
No, so that was from the scene where Robin places flowers for Kara Wolfson, which is one of my favorite added things in that adaptation.
Yeah, me too.
That. So did the showrunners know that this was a location in 7? Or did Jo see it in the show and be like, oh, I'm going to throw that in 7? Or is it just a complete coincidence?
I don't know.
I don't know. And I want to know.
But is this our first London-based header for The Running Grave?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. Everything else has been Norfolk or I Ching.
Yeah. And thanks to Sue and Katie, we've seen that right across the street from that, the street is filled with red lanterns.
And that's significant because Jo has used that emoji, right? Whenever she's talking about the book, she'll use like the headstone, the wave, and then the lantern.
So yeah, I wonder if we'll be visiting this area a lot. It's kind of near the office. I looked it up and it's just an 8-minute walk.
Oh, that's quick.
Yeah. So I have to imagine that this area, the street, is going to be tied to the I Ching epigraphs, the lantern emoji. She used the wave emoji again, which tells me that water is important, or the beach, maybe.
Water's going to be another important liquid.
It's another important liquid, yeah.
It's already a very important liquid. We're about to get a lot of mileage out of that.
Mm-hmm. Important liquids, pardon.
Yeah. We should make mugs that say important liquid.
It's been on my to-do list for like 2 years. I swear to God, I keep meaning to get around to it.
There's also, so on this street, I noticed that there is a little cafe called CNR.
Oh, that's cute. Mm.
That's adorable.
My God. That is the kind of thing that Robin would totally notice and think about, just like she noticed the CBS license plate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's going to be like middle school doodling CNR in her notebook.
Her noticing things like that for embarrassing and very in love reasons are among some of my top wishes for Running Grave.
But how cute would it be if Strike is the one who noticed it, though?
It would be adorable.
That would be really cute.
Strike is even more doodling in his notebook.
Yeah. I feel like he's a mushy guy.
Oh, yeah.
I think that after this past book, I think that the era of For Some Reason is now officially over.
No, but For Some Reason.
You're right, though. Yeah, he knows what that reason is now. Mm-hmm. Aww. Does anyone know what's on the street? Is it just restaurants or are there other businesses there? Because my mind goes straight to therapy offices, maybe.
Oh, how cool would it be if Prue's office was just down the road from Strike's?
That would be cool.
That would be awesome. I think I heard that there used to be strip clubs or something on that street.
Can Robin say, what's it like in there?
Like, it's a trick question.
I love when she says that. What? So great.
Robin, Strike just doesn't know how to answer. He's like, whoa.
There's girls.
What are you asking me to describe? The carpet's red?
Oh, that's
red?
Such a good moment between them. So yeah, funny. Is.
Oh, I love it.
Ken, do you want to talk about the thing that you found?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I did find something that was pretty cool. I'm not sure exactly how significant it is, but...
Yeah, because we don't understand things.
We might need somebody who has more expertise mm-hmm. than yeah. us for, yeah, this particular thing. So in my desperation for wanting to know more about the Running Grave, I decided to look up the Running Grave on the government trademark listing for Running Grave. Mm-hmm. And for each of the books, there's different trademark categories and stuff like that. And there'll be like copyrights that'll reference it being a book, different stuff that's included in the book sometimes. So like in Troubled Blood, there's stuff like perfumes or poisons and stuff like that that's mentioned mm-hmm. in there. Now, there's not a whole lot of information for Running Grave yet. There's a few categories that all the books hold in common as far as what they're filed under. But a few things that are interesting that are listed in the trademark categories for the Running Grave are, and let me just pull it up here because we actually are going to do a blog post on this and you all will be able to read it. But it mentions diving suits, divers masks, earplugs for divers, nose clips for divers and swimmers, gloves for mm-hmm. divers, breathing apparatus for underwater swimming, and fire extinguishing apparatuses.
Fire extinguishers. That's very exciting. The diving is exciting to me. Mm-hmm. Fire extinguishing is also very exciting because I would love for them to be trapped in a room with a fire. And
it would all be very dramatic.
It would all be incredibly dramatic, yes. Lindsay's about to say you're a fucking lunatic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, but, you know, in a nicer way.
Sure, sure.
I think it literally could just mean that she describes a fire extinguisher. Yeah. There could be like a boat that has all of the safety equipment and stuff, because in my mind, I've always assumed that they're probably going to need to look for a body in water.
Yeah.
So there could be all of this kind of life-saving equipment.
And I guess you do want a fire extinguisher on a boat, because if a boat
definitely
fire,
do. Yeah.
That's not good. Okay. This is exciting. So
yeah, it is exciting though. We just don't really understand what it means.
Wonder if Polworth could come back to help them out.
I was thinking that too. Yeah.
Across country. He dives.
He does dive.
Yeah.
I don't know. In my head, it's a big thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
We'll see what happens. But I do think body and water, mm-hmm. not just Strike swimming.
Oh, I was hoping for that, man.
I'm saying not just.
That's some really good detective work, Ken's.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it is. Impressed.
I hope that it actually pans out to something and this isn't just a wild shot in the dark, but I'm it sure would be it very be. Exciting if true.
You said perfumes were in Troubled Blood. Those were mm-hmm. incredibly important. They were mm-hmm. essential.
Mm-hmm. And there's fungicides, herbicides, poison, all kinds of stuff in there. Yeah.
Oh, Ken, speaking of blog posts, you mentioned that this will be on the blog, the copyright info. We have the pleasure of hosting another blog post from our friend Kurt. And in it, he talks about the history of literary and artistic association of graves with rebirth, with new life, with creative inspiration. And he talks about what this might mean for the running grave. And I love this post. It was really exciting to get to read it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really excited about some of those predictions as well.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
Particularly number three.
Number three is our favorite. So listeners, if you haven't yet read Kurt's blog post, please hop on over to our website and give it a look. It's really, really exciting.
Yes. And thank you to Kurt for letting us share it.
Yeah. Big thanks. I hope that we can convince him to write more stuff for us.
Yeah. Speaking of blog posts, just a quick note that Louise Freeman has started her own blog called, actually, Pools, did you want to share the name of it?
Do I have to?
I'm just joking.
You all know what it's named.
I'm just joking.
It is now called The Blog That Must Not Be Named.
It is fartingsofafaculty.blogspot.com, and we can throw in a link to that as well. So she's planning on posting about Strike and Harry Potter and some other things. So go check that out. It's going to be great.
I'm excited for this. I am.
Let's talk about the other news we got the other day, though.
Oh my God, there's so much news.
So much news.
This came from the Robert Galbraith newsletter, and there's a few very interesting things.
It's not the usual place one finds news, the Robert Galbraith newsletter. That's usually the last place we'd expect
or
to hear
interesting
actual
things
news from. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm going to be throwing a lot of shade.
Yeah.
Because I think that we should be in charge of all marketing.
Okay, Anime. Calm down.
I'm just saying, I think we could do a better job.
So in the announcement for the release date, it referred to The Running Grave as the seventh title in a planned series of 10.
Oh.
So we've heard this before, but this seems more official. There's also a quote at the bottom. I can't wait to see what happens to them over the course of the final four books in the series.
Oh my gosh.
And J.K. Rowling also took to Twitter to say that she does think that it's going to be 10. But I'm thinking that this is very likely what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. J.K. Rowling also said in another tweet that she knows the ending and she can't work any other way. So my thought is that the only way it wouldn't be 10 is if she decides along the way that something needs to be spread out a bit. But I don't think that this would be announced like this if it wasn't a set plan.
I definitely agree. Do you think that maybe it was in the course of writing The Running Grave that she finally finalized, okay, I need...
No, I think she's known all along. Yeah.
Okay.
I think she's known all along. She just wasn't sure how long it was going to take her or how many books it was going to take to tell the story.
That makes sense to me. I kind of have a faint hope that it could need 11 books total.
11.
Just because the more the merrier. But also, listen, does anyone else feel this? But knowing that Rowling knows the ending makes me absolutely desperate to know what the ending is. Like, I'm guessing that, you know, wedding bells are ringing.
I mean, you know what I think about that. For a guy who isn't the marrying kind, he's obsessed with marriage when it comes to Robin. Obsessed.
Very much so.
Always thinking about men proposing or wanting to marry her.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the line from Lethal White that I love, you know.
Love it.
I just want to say this again because I saw that some people were upset by this news. But I do feel really pleased by this because the thing I think J.K. Rowling does so beautifully is knowing what the ending is and planting those seeds along the way. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can have an open-ended book series and have a planned ending at the same time. Mm-hmm. So to me, I prefer this type of closure. I'm beyond excited to start seeing how she follows up with everything and completes the story.
Yeah.
It's going to be so beautiful.
I totally agree with you. I would much rather have a definitive planned ending.
Yeah.
I want Cormen and Robin's arcs to come full circle to a satisfying conclusion. I want it to feel complete, and I'm happy with where it ends rather than just having it hanging.
I think that book series that go on forever like that are better suited to series that really are more about the crime plots and not about the characters.
Yeah.
Because you can always have a good crime fiction plot, but I think with those types of books, I always feel like the character stuff is lacking.
Yeah.
Because there's no real direction that they're traveling in. And then I lose interest.
Same.
So also the Robert Galbraith newsletter talked about the 10-year anniversary of The Cuckoo's Calling. So it says that fans will have the opportunity to purchase a special anniversary edition of The Cuckoo's Calling produced with exclusive artwork.
Huh.
This is really exciting.
Yes.
The way it's worded makes me a little nervous. Having the opportunity to purchase it makes me worry that it's limited.
Oh, it had better not be, because I want that book.
Yeah.
Also, can we have illustrated editions of all the books, please? Because
yes,
I have some choice scenes that I would really like illustrations of.
Now, which ones would those be, right?
I mean, do you want an itemized list?
Sure, give me a few ideas right now.
I mean, strike in the swimming pool. A. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The hug. B.
The kiss on the cheek at the end of Trouble Blood.
Yes. Oh, the accidental kiss.
Oh,
hospital
yes.
Parking lot.
Yeah.
Accidental
yeah.
kiss.
Oh, also his face when he sees Robin walking down the hallway at the hospital. That would be really good too.
Yes. Oh my God. Ooh. Yeah. Robin's face when he shows up at the wedding.
Everything. Everything. Yeah,
just
you're right.
All, just everything. Illustrate the whole fucking thing.
The other day when she was tweeting, I don't think that anybody was asking her about this. And I wish that I would have thought to, because I wonder who did the illustrations.
And will the person who's illustrated it be in close consultation with her so that we get her mental image?
If she didn't do it herself, did she do like one of those police sketches? Because that would be really cool.
Just take my money.
Just
take all my money.
The announcement also said a year-long run of activity is planned to celebrate this milestone, including a creative consumer campaign that will revisit key elements of Strike and give readers the opportunity to share their favorite moments.
Wow.
What does that mean?
Double the crosswords.
Oh,
crosswords
boy.
Out the wazoo. You won't even be able to see your desk for all the goddamn crosswords they're going to put across it. I'm so excited for this.
Yeah. More calculated mediocrity on the part of the Robert Galbraith social media team.
More typos.
No faith from either of you two.
They have given me no reason to have any at this point.
Well, I guess we'll see.
We will see. You know what? Hire me. I'll put together the best campaign you've ever seen. I got a great campaign. I got all the ideas, the best ideas.
Best ideas and the best words.
Make the Robert Galbraith account great again.
That's the first step in my very long campaign, yes.
Okay. Anyway, let's go back to Twitter, though, because another one of Joe's tweets that I wanted to talk about, because it was really funny, was the one about Ryan Murphy. Someone said, really hoping Ryan Murphy gets offered a job with Interpol and will have to move to France. And Joe said, this made me laugh, but you must admit he's an improvement on Matthew Cunliffe.
That is not a high bar to clear. The bar is on the floor.
The bar is in the basement, guys.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just taking this as confirmation that Murphy is not a bad guy.
Yeah.
That's what I've thought all along. So
yeah.
Thank goodness. Not that that was something I was super like worried about or anything, but it's nice to have confirmation.
The other tweet of hers that I really wanted to talk about is when she was responding to this question that said, Joe, after so many releases, are you still nervous/anxious for it? And she said, yes, because you don't want to let fans down. I'm so grateful for the way readers have embraced Strike and Robin. I can only say that I love this one and I hope you do too.
No.
So many feelings there. I responded that J.K. Rowling has never let me down. So I'm so excited to hear that she loves this one, because I think that means that I'm going to love it, obviously, too.
And did you get a like from her on that tweet?
I did.
You did. So exciting. But yeah, that's such a sweet response. I love her. You know what? I can already guarantee that The Running Grave is going to become my new favorite book, just like every single book in this series has.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that a lot.
All right. I think that's all the news so far.
Oh, my goodness. 2 weeks of Twitter summed up.
Oh, there was one other tweet where someone said that Ink Black Heart made them rejoin Twitter, and she said, God, I'm so sorry.
She is so funny. I wish I could be that funny. Honest to God. Envious. Okay. Yeah.
That was really good. Thanks, that made me laugh out loud. Okay, should we get to our Q&A?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, so the Q&A for this episode, since this episode is going to have a bunch of stuff about Kay and Nevin in it, we chose the one about birds.
Yay.
So the question for this one is, do you have a thing about birds?
I like the way you said that.
That's a hilarious question.
Well, look at how it's written.
I know. A question mark, exclamation point. Yeah.
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 Pretty funny.
Okay, let's play Joe's answer.
Yeah.
Do I have a thing about birds? I do have a bit of a thing about birds. There's a lot of bird symbolism in this book, which was conscious, obviously. Birds have an association of messenger, you know, in lots of cultures. And I was playing a lot with the idea of inspiration. You know, you many people, me included, find their own source of inspiration quite perplexing. You know, I can't honestly say where some ideas came from. They just came. And so I love the idea of bird messengers. They're also creatures of omen. You know, across most cultures, you have an idea of something ominous. And that would apply to this book. And there's also the image, which has always fascinated me, of the pelican in its piety, which is a heraldic device you often see on shields and so forth. And that device is used on one grave in the cemetery. And I refer to that grave in this book. In fact, I use that image twice in the book. And that to me, although it obviously has other... The pelican in its piety is plucking its own breast to shed blood to feed its chicks. And it does sometimes feel like you're shedding a bit of blood, I suppose. So yeah, it worked for me on all sorts of different levels, comic as well. But yeah, there are a lot of birds in this book, I know that. But I was aware of it. It wasn't an accident.
I wish I could add to this question and ask her to tell us if she has a thing about swans. Mm. According to my very professional Googling, swans are a symbol for love, and she has to know that.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah. That's the whole thing. It's the whole thing. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, this one is, I'm trying to unpick this, and I have so many thoughts swirling around in my head, from Robin's name being Robin, Cormoran being one letter off from a cormorant. The swan symbolism, like, they are really associated with birds throughout the whole series.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that she focuses on the symbolism as birds as messengers here. And it makes me think messengers, messages. So the book starts off with an unspoken message between Cormoran and Robin, that almost kiss, right? Cormoran is sending a message, which is that he wants Robin, but he's not making the message she wants to hear, which is that he wants her for more than just sex, clear enough. And Robin sends a message back, and it's described as that in the text, but Cormoran can't interpret it properly because he's not inside her head. So this whole calamity in the book with their personal life starts off with a message being interrupted or not received correctly. And throughout the book, there are other messages, like Cormoran's body is trying to send a message to him that he's refusing to listen to. My point is that I don't know what my point is, but it feels like receiving the message and properly sending the message are important things that don't happen in this book or don't happen in time.
This is a tough one.
It is a tough one. But I think the thing about messages is a theme that I'm going to have to look at more closely going forward, because I think there's something here.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the only other thing I thought was that Twitter has a bird.
Yeah, well, the book is also, it's full of messages that we get to read.
Yeah.
Chats and Twitter
is the worst bird in the book, tied with that vicious cockatoo.
Yeah, I would love to just ask listeners, I just want to know what your thoughts are on the whole bird thing, because it feels like there's so much here that my brain isn't connecting. I'm sure that there are lots of people who are much smarter than me who could do something with this. I'd really like to hear everyone's thoughts on the thing with birds.
Tweet us about the birds.
Tweet about the birds, please. Tweet, tweet. Should we jump into the chapters? Because we forgot to say earlier that the whole starting five chapters is starting now, because it has to. Otherwise, we're not going to finish on time. So last week when we said that it's, you know, whatever chapters, it's going to be more.
So in chapter 48, Strike speaks with Kay and Niven's mother.
Okay, so the epigraph. Sometimes, as young things will, she vexes me, wayward or too unheeding or too blind. Like aimless birds that, flying on a wind, strike slant against their own familiar tree. And that's Mother and Daughter by Augusta Webster.
Oh, this is interesting. Mother and Daughter, I must be referring to, obviously, Sarah and Kia. It's interesting to me that the mother in this poem looks at her daughter and she sees perfection. She sees innocence, beauty, sweetness. But even vexing her in this epigraph, it reads as if it's not really the daughter's fault. It's not any crime of malice. It's just foolishness, youth. And since her penitence is sincere in the poem, the mother forgives her instantly. She can't not forgive her. And it seems to me that Kia's mother has a very similar view of Kia, except Sarah seems to have taken this sort of maternal perspective to a place where it becomes willful blindness. It seems like she believes everything her daughter says, bows to Kia's every whim, takes her side on every issue. It's this mother-daughter love and bond taken too far, to a point where it's destructive and enabling rather than truly loving, because real parental love has boundaries and guidance.
I totally agree with you. Sarah seems to be the type to never hold Kia accountable, which I think also extends to her bird.
Yeah, she has a very similar parenting and birding style.
The whole strike slant against your own familiar tree. To me, what that made me think of is that Sarah Niven might get the worst of Kia's behavior because she's the closest person to her, the safest one to lash out at. And I think we see that happening in this chapter.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, going back to the birds, there's another bird reference here. So in this chapter, Strike gets attacked by that bird, but it's interesting because in the epigraph, it compares the she, the daughter, to a bird. Mm. I'm wondering if there are ways that we can look at Kia's behavior and the bird, because I feel like that cockatoo is just a ticking time bomb, and it seems like Kia is very similar in the way that she lashes out.
Yeah, I think that this cockatoo and Kia are birds of a feather.
Yeah.
So Strike wakes up to get ready to drive to Kingsland so he can interview Kea, and it says that his mood had been lifted by a text from Murphy. And something tells me that'll be one of the last texts from Murphy, work-related or not, that lightens his mood for a very long time.
Yeah, poor guy.
Yeah, I felt the same thing when I was reading this. So what's the over-under on how many? Robin looked at her phone and smiled. Strike wondered if it was Murphy proposing marriage to her over text. Mm-hmm. Moments where are we gonna get in the running grave, because I'm guessing at least 10
at least
where Robin is doing something completely unrelated and Strike is like, is she in love with Murphy? Helen up Shanker, I have a problem, I need you to take care of it.
Strike gets a call from Kea Niven's mother Sarah saying that Kea can't make the interview, which surprise surprise, right?
Yeah, I knew this was coming.
I love that Strike also knew it was coming. He knew the second he saw there's a voicemail that that's what it was going to be.
So Robin's not sure that pushing on the interview with Kea is a good idea, but Strike reminds her that Kea is currently Robin's favorite choice for anime. Yep. And I liked this little bit of vulnerability that he was showing, where it says, given the events of the previous week, he was feeling slightly sensitive about any suggestion that he might be acting recklessly.
I totally get why he'd feel defensive, but also I think I would do the same thing. Just show up. Because it reminds me of how he's often thought about the disadvantage of being a private investigator as compared to the authority he had in the SIB, because he can't compel Kea to talk to him. So I'm glad that Robin does recognize this and agrees that Kea could just keep putting them off forever.
Yeah.
What would you guys do? Because I would just go too.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. I do think that just showing up at Kia's was the right move, because Robin's right.
Yeah.
She's just going to keep putting you off. She's never going to agree to see you. He's going to have to force the issue eventually. It's his job.
So Strike makes his way to King's Lynn, and this next bit, especially knowing what we know about Running Grave, definitely reads as a bit of foreshadowing.
Oh yeah.
The news about Montgomery was so cheering that Strike didn't much mind his first glimpse of a windmill or the change in landscape to wide, flat fens and marshland. He never went voluntarily into Norfolk and, in fact, had a slight prejudice against the whole county because the worst of all of the many places to which Strike's novelty-chasing, peripatetic mother had taken her son and daughter to live had been a Norfolk commune, a place Strike sincerely hoped no longer existed.
I felt this way even when first reading the book, and now with all the Norfolk headers, I'm sure that's what this is.
Yeah, me too. And it is really ominous for me, because how bad must that place have been to turn him off an entire county?
Yeah.
And never voluntarily going there? That's pretty powerful trauma. And thinking back to what we know about the commune, there was a description of a dank dormitory. And that would seem to fit with the commune that's out in the like countryside in that marshland that he's talking about. Very damp and miserable.
It makes me really sad because they were so young.
I am both excited and dreading more about the commune.
That last line too, a place Strike sincerely hoped no longer existed. It makes me worried that it still does exist.
Yep, me too. It seems to suggest that whatever happened there, it didn't result in a scandal big enough to get the place shut down in Strike's memory. So presumably whatever perpetrators of abuse were there, they were never brought to justice.
I hope it's not still around, but I guess we'll find out.
I don't know. It'd be pretty satisfying if it was still around, but then Strike got to wipe it off the map.
It would be, but I'm thinking how old would these people be now?
Yeah, it would have to be a pretty long-running commune.
Like 32 years later.
Oh, yeah. Probably not.
After Strike drives to Norfolk, he arrives at Kea Niven's house, and as expected, no one is happy to see him.
Yeah, not even the bird.
That is so weird to me, because if Strike pulled up at my front door, I would be thrilled. I'd be like, interview me.
Yeah.
Crush me. Whatever.
DDT is my bathroom.
I'll have to supervise. I'm sorry. Don't want you snooping.
You're going to ask for your own personal private investigation.
Investigate.
That got thirsty real quick.
Yeah. Sorry, that got real stupid on my part.
Yeah. Oh, man. Okay. What do we think of Shrike taking his walking stick, even though he didn't feel the need? Mm. Do we think this is different from Kia using illness as manipulation?
Hmm.
I think it's very obvious that Kia uses this against the people in her life, her personal relationships. So I don't have a problem with Shrike using manipulation to fight manipulation from a suspect. I don't ever think we've seen him do this to get sympathy from Robin or someone.
No, and I don't think he would. I think the idea that, well, we know sympathy is distasteful to him. He doesn't want it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree with you. It's like you said in Cuckoo's Calling, all's fair when it comes to getting a witness statement. Sure, it's manipulation, but doesn't mean it's morally wrong. He's using the tools at hand to get the job done, and he's doing it in service of the greater good, not just for his own interests like Kia might be.
The way that Shrike uses his disability here as a way to manipulate both Sarah and Kea to get information is completely different to how Kea seems to use hers. You don't ever really even see him acknowledge his disability in his normal personal life, much less using it as a point of manipulation to control how the people in his life perceive him or treat him.
We see a lot of contrasts between him and Kea in this chapter, but we also see a lot of comparisons between Kea and Charlotte,
mm-hmm.
which is very interesting. And I'm like, what element does this add to the sort of Josh Cormoran, Edie Robin, Kea Charlotte triad that we've got going on here? It's interesting, the parallels being set up between these three people.
So surprising everybody, considering that...
Or no one.
Or nobody. Yeah, I guess that's true. Kea runs out the back door. God, I guess before we get into this, I want to be sensitive about this, and I want to give her the benefit of the doubt regarding her illness, because obviously invisible illnesses are a thing. But I do find it interesting, I'll say, that a woman who says that she has a condition that makes it difficult to not only like just get up, but also to exercise, is hauling ass out the back door and has run to a pub that is so far away that it's really not worth going by foot and you need to go there by car. I just find it a little interesting.
A little bit sus.
Okay, look, if we're going to do the chapter properly, we're going to have to go there because it's a really important part of the discussion.
Yeah.
I would bet that every single person reading this book has the exact same question.
Absolutely.
It doesn't mean that we doubt people with invisible illnesses. It means that we doubt Kea. In fact, it's pointed out later on when it says, yeah, Kea mentioned on the phone that she's been bedbound, said Shrike. There followed another short pause in which the fact that Kea had just run out of the house seemed to reverberate like an echo through the room.
Just like, so funny. Sorry.
It also, yeah, it's good line. It also says in the same conversation that all of her blood work has come back normal and that they recommend psychotherapy. And basically from what Sarah says, it seems to me like they've self-diagnosed via the internet.
Yeah.
So I think we do have enough information to make a guess that Kea might not have any physical illnesses. I'm not sure if Kea knows that. I don't know what the real answer is, but I think at least this is obvious.
She may very well truly believe that she is sick, and she may believe it so much that she gives herself the physical symptom, which absolutely is a thing that can happen. It's just made me think, is this another application of just because it's in your head doesn't mean that it's not real?
Yeah. Although I wonder how she justifies running out the back door, but...
Well, yeah, maybe. Like the super strength that mothers have to lift objects off of the babies, except it's the super strength to run away from detectives you don't want to talk to.
Yeah.
I think the key here, when you're talking about Kea, is the way she uses whatever condition she has to manipulate, to try and get sympathy, to try and get what she wants, right? Because that she does that is, to me, incredibly apparent. And yeah, the fact she can apparently shut it all down to just run out the back door seems like a pretty big red flag to me.
Who knew that she was a cross-country runner?
Yeah.
We had no idea.
Yeah, and as a quick side note, this is another mention of therapy that I don't think I thought of when I was thinking about all the ways therapy is mentioned in this book and what it could mean for Shrike. And this one feels even more important because Shrike does later have some physical symptoms as a result of stress, like his face twitching.
Oh, that is such a good point. I would love to see him give up and go to get therapy in the next book because the twitch comes back.
Every time Ryan Murphy's mentioned
his twitching. Ryan Murphy shows up and Shrike's eye starts twitching.
But But anyway, I think this is an important question because she's not trustworthy. She's extremely manipulative, and wondering if she's faking an illness keeps her status as a suspect high or good. So just from a guessing the killer standpoint, it's important to question why her story doesn't seem consistent.
You know what? That's true. Sometimes I forget that I'm supposed to be thinking that these people are murder suspects.
Yeah, they are.
I'm like, I completely forget that I'm supposed to be like, oh, she could be the murderer.
Right.
It's like, oh, that Kia. You know that her. That Kia. No, I'm supposed to be thinking, did she kill someone?
Yeah. And also her behavior before she runs out the back door is kind of shocking. I mean, this woman is 25 years old and she's screaming in front of a total stranger like a toddler having a fit. If she acts like that in front of him, I just can imagine what it's like the rest of the time.
It reminds me kind of what we said whenever Strike and Robin went to go interview the Upcotts and what we were saying about Inigo's behavior towards Katya. Like, if that's how he's willing to behave with two total strangers in his house, you can only imagine how much worse it is whenever they're alone.
Yeah, those two, Kia and Inigo, are birds of a feather.
Ah, more of them.
More birds.
It's a whole flock of assholes.
Also, the fact that the parrot keeps saying, please, Kia, that's saying a lot.
It really is. She must do this often for the parrot to have that kind of response, like trained into it, basically. Oh, wow.
While Strike is at the Niven's house, Strike pulls out the Strike and Ellicott Detective Agency's number one favorite tactic for snooping. You know it. You love it. It's asking to use their restroom.
At least I now know that if a PI ever shows up to my house and asks to use my bathroom, the correct course of action is to be like, hell no.
Absolutely.
Get your
not.
Ass out of my house.
I know what that's code for.
I know what you're doing. You're not going through my underwear drawer or whatever. No.
I noticed that Sarah talks about how Kia had to leave college because of her mental health. And I'm wondering if this is a link back to Gus or some sort of tie-in to get us to remember that Gus is also in that situation.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there.
This is the only area in which I'm a bit sympathetic to Kia. Robin also had to leave university because of her mental health.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not unsympathetic. I just think it's an interesting link and a reminder to Gus. Something that's maybe calling our attention back to him.
Yeah, I can see that. That's interesting. And something I didn't really pick up on.
Did either of you see any significance with the caged lovebirds here? Speaking Joe having a thing with birds.
Yeah, all of these birds have given me a bird brain, I think is what happened. Sarah has these two birds in a cage, but the cockatoo is flying freely around. It feels significant that she has the Nivens have all of these birds and then also acknowledge all the bird symbolism. I can't think of what it all means.
The fact that the lovebirds are caged and can't carry a message. And the fact that the uncaged bird, who's a maniac, injures Strike.
Yeah.
I want to say that it's all symbolic of him locking down his feelings for Robin and messing around where he shouldn't be with Madeline. And that's going to end up hurting him. But that's a reach beyond my usual reaching skills.
Well, hey, now, hold on. I'm glad that you said Madeline, because I was also thinking this, because he gets attacked by this cockatoo, but he also gets attacked by Madeline later on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speak of birds of a feather.
I don't think that's a big reach.
Okay.
And in the beginning of the next chapter, Sarah is glaring at Strike out of the window like it's his fault. And he can see the cockatoo sitting on top of the lovebird's cage. So I was kind of thinking the same thing. They're caged and not free because this problem bird, Madeline, is roaming around attacking people.
Madeline is a problem bird.
She's a problem bird.
You know what? Okay, yeah. Now I'm starting to think that I wasn't reaching that much after all. Now I've got validation.
Well, we were thinking the same thing.
I like it. Okay, it's all symbolism.
We're probably so wrong, but you know, that's where my mind went.
No, yeah, I agree.
Like I said earlier, I would really like to ask for listener input on the whole bird thing, because I feel like there's someone out there who has a wonderful interpretation of the birds, and I would love to hear it.
Better thoughts about the birds. I too would like to hear that.
Another thing, while Sarah goes outside to call Kia to convince her to come talk to Strike, he notices bird poop on the floor in front of the fridge.
Oh,
in front of the fridge where there's food.
Oh, hell no. Hell
no. That
is
so gross.
Do you know how many diseases birds carry?
Well, I was thankful for this detail because earlier in the chapter, when Strike is thinking how the house is messy because the dishes aren't done and there's toast crumbs Right. I was feeling a little bit called out because let me tell you, right now with two kids, breadcrumbs are the least of my worries. But I was like, at least I don't have bird poop in my house, you know?
You know what? It's a bar and we've cleared it.
Thank you.
You're doing pretty good.
We're all winning then. I too do not have bird poop in front of my fridge.
Awesome. That's really good to know.
Three for three. We're crushing it.
One of the things that makes me laugh when Strike overhears what Sarah is saying over the phone is, yes, he's brought a folder. It's funny because it tells us that Strike's comments about having documents must have really scared her.
Oh no, not the big bad documents.
Yeah, that's good.
If I was Strike, I would have stuffed the folder with like extra blank paper just to make it look real thick. Like a thick folder, like heavy duty.
Before the bird attacks him, it does feel like this was a ticking time bomb throughout the whole chapter.
The bird was a lurking presence, an evil presence, just waiting for its opportunity. Yes. I would not turn my back on that bird or my front on that bird. I would put no part of my body in conversation with that bird.
And the whole attack feels really awful because it's described as a razor sharp beak right into his temple, which is awful.
Ouch. Yeah.
And the fact that the bird clung to him from the kitchen to the front door.
Oh no.
I would be freaking out.
I'd have lost it completely. I would have 100% reflexively smacked the bird.
Yeah.
Sarah is frankly lucky as hell that Strike didn't, because he would have been justified. Like,
I mean, I would have smacked it intentionally.
Yeah.
It's attacking you.
Yeah.
I mean, if birds are messengers, what message is this? I mean, the only thing I could think is it's foreshadowing for Madeline attacking him later.
Yeah. Yeah.
It could also be an insight into Kia's character, since the epigraph ties her to birds. Mm-hmm. There's also, I know the connection's been made to Ron getting attacked by birds in Half-Blood Prince.
Yes.
Which is definitely a message right from Hermione about her feelings about Lavender.
I've loved that little Easter egg parallel ever since I first realized it was there. Because, yeah, it is a whack upside the head to Strike from the universe, delivered by way of the bird. Probably stop messing around with this woman who's not Robin.
I guess Madeline is Lavender Brown.
Oh my gosh, she is Lavender Brown.
We really should have seen Madeline coming in six, shouldn't we?
Really,
hey, well, at least she doesn't use anything horrifying like Wanwan.
Imagine if she said Corm Corm.
Oh, God. It's like Strike's love life, just a series of Lavender Browns. My dude, why? I love that you've connected these dots.
We've kind of said this before, but Sarah Niven's response to this really annoys me when she's like, don't hit him, don't open the door. Is she crazy?
Seriously. Yes.
If your animal is attacking someone, causing blood to pour down his face, and she doesn't want him to push the bird away or escape,
That's crazy.
I don't get it.
That's crazy. Yeah.
The one thing that I'll give to Kia in the next chapter is she apologizes for the bird attacking him and says that her mother sets no boundaries with him. And I think she's right about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also, skipping ahead, this bird's name is Ozzy. The other birds are named after musical references, right? Is this another one? Is this Ozzy Osbourne? That's the only musical Ozzy I know.
Probably. I'm thinking whatever the inspiration, which I'm thinking you're probably right. It's probably Ozzy Osbourne. But I do think it's funny because the meaning of the name Ozzy means divine protector, warrior, or ruler. So that seems kind of appropriate given what the bird does to Strike before he meets up with Kea.
All right, let's go to 49.
In chapter 49, Strike interviews Kea Niven.
The epigraph to 49 reads, "And in her lurid eyes there shone the dying flame of life's desire, made mad because its hope was gone, and kindled at the leaping fire of jealousy and fierce revenge and strength that could not change nor tire." And that's from The Other Side of a Mirror by Mary Elizabeth Coleridge. Interesting to me that the other occurrence of this specific poem in the novel, Other Side of a Mirror, is when Strike goes to visit Yasmin. It feels like it's kind of connecting the two women somehow.
Yeah, I don't know how they're connected.
Yeah. So the poem itself is speaking to this sort of inner torment and suffering of a woman that's hidden behind, stuffed down beneath the performance of happiness, the performance of beauty, the conformity. So much so that the speaker does not even recognize herself when her suffering is revealed in the mirror, because she has pushed down her misery so much. But I think that there's a layer of irony when we apply this to Kia, because she is very consciously conjuring this image of herself. She is conjuring this image of herself as an object of pity, as a victim, and she's conjured it so hard that she she believes it fully. When the speaker in the poem pushes the image away, pushing it down, Kia clings to it, loves this image, feeds it, embraces it. I don't think that we would call Kia an objective observer of what's actually in the mirror.
Maybe that's the connection to Yasmin, because I don't think she would either.
Yes. Yeah.
I guess my initial read of this is partly sad and partly yikes, because the dying flame of life's desire and hope is gone felt very sad to me. But then you get to the second half with the leaping fire of jealousy and fierce revenge, and that's less sympathetic. It makes me think of Charlotte a bit, because we've talked before about the similarities between Charlotte and Kia. And one thing that people really like discussing is what it's going to take to get Charlotte to back off.
Yeah.
And this implying strength that could not change nor tire.
Yeah, this does seem a bit ominous in regards to Charlotte too, with whom there's so many parallels set up in this chapter. That makes me nervous.
And yeah, I know.
A little bit. That makes me anxious for what Charlotte is not going to go quiet into the good night.
To start the chapter, Strike escapes that terrible cockatoo a little worse for wear. He's bleeding and he encounters an old guy on the street.
I love this old man.
Yeah, he seems sweet.
First, I love that he calls Strike boy. I don't know why, but that's so endearing to me.
It's like when Ted does it.
Yeah. But also the implication that this man has also been attacked by this bird is frustrating.
I bet this old neighbor and his wife have so many conversations about the Nivens over their tea.
They probably hear a lot through the walls if the houses are close by.
I bet it's a frequent topic of conversation for them.
When Strike calls Robin, there is a part here that I'm just curious if it's just a minor American English versus British English sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I've never heard anybody call a tidbit a titbit.
Yeah, me either.
Does anybody else have that in their ebook? Because I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, it's in mine too, but no, I say tidbit too.
Yeah, the Cambridge Dictionary seems to suggest it is a UK versus US pronunciation. I've never seen it either. It's tidbit up here as well.
Yeah. So in the previous chapter, Strike had managed to take a picture of Kia's search history on her computer, and there's a couple interesting things. Yeah. First, she Googled him, which kind of looks like my search history. I wonder if she Googled him before she wanted to cancel, or if she saw something that freaked her out.
Oh, maybe what a good detective he is.
Mm-hmm.
But the progression of her Cormoran Strike searches made me laugh a little. First, it's just his name, then leg, then Johnny Rugby. I'm just guessing there are quite a few suspects whose browser histories have looked a lot like that just before Strike questioned them.
Well, the other thing that I think is interesting is that she searched Comic-Con. Because that's kind of keeping her suspect status up there.
Yeah.
Because we know that Anime is so invested in people going to Comic-Con.
Right.
So when they get to the pub, though, this is a kind of a silly question, but I can't help but be curious about why Strike orders himself a non-alcoholic beer.
I just assumed it was driving, wants to stay sober for the interview. I don't know.
Yeah, I know he's driving, but I guess I'm asking, like, what is the point of a non-alcoholic beer? Because every time they order them, it's because they want to give the impression that they're actually drinking.
Oh, okay. I get you.
So did he order one to make Kia feel like, this is casual, I'm having a beer, you know? Or does it taste the same and he just wanted it?
Yeah, maybe he wanted Kia to think he was drinking real beer.
That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah,
that's what I'm thinking too. I can't imagine Strike actively seeking out non-alcoholic beer to drink outside of like stuff for
because
work.
That's what I didn't want to say, what's the point of it? But what's the point of it? It doesn't have alcohol in it.
Indeed.
What's the point?
Yeah.
But also, do we have anything else to say about how it says that she reminds him of Charlotte? Because there's this mention in just a bit where Kia starts sobbing and it says, Charlotte hadn't minded witnesses either. Tears, screams, threatening to jump off high buildings. He endured it all in front of friends and occasionally passers-by.
Friends? I'm guessing that means in front of Nick and Ilsa, right?
Probably.
Yeah.
Or Polar.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I was thinking. How embarrassing and just awful.
Yeah.
That's probably why he avoided them. I mean, we know that he didn't talk to Nick and Ilsa for a while.
Yeah.
I have to point out this tiny thing that endears me to Strike. So after Kia is done crying, he asks her who she thinks Anime is, and she says, who cares what I think? And he responds, I do. But it specifically notes that he says it not unkindly.
No.
And I don't know, it's just, Kia is someone who is very difficult to have a lot of sympathy for.
Part of me thinks that he's acting in a way likely to make her talk in the moment, like it's strategic. But, you know, he isn't an unkind person. But dealing with Charlotte for so many years, he likely has a very ingrained response to this kind of behavior, like a Pavlovian response. See how he treats Madeline at the end of the launch fight chapter, at the end of the section.
Oh, he becomes tender.
Yeah, almost. Like an appeasing.
I wonder if Leda was tender after an explosion or after she was gone for a long time.
Oh, jeez.
Trauma response.
Lot to unpack in therapy there for you, Strake.
When Kia talks about Edie stealing her ideas, I do believe that she believes this.
I do too, but it's just so crazy. Like, it's yeah. so crazy. Because even if these ideas were hers and were stolen, neither of which is true, if that was true, wouldn't it be Josh who stole them? Since it was
yes.
Josh she told him to, and Josh who co-created the cartoon with Edie? Yeah, like, what the fuck?
I know, I think about this all the time. It's almost as logical as parrot-brained Tim Ashcroft the pedophile saying that Wally's video proves that the Ink Black Heart is anti-Semitic. It's the same kind of terrible logic.
Like the leaps in logic. It's not actual logic. It's just deciding what you want to be true and then just saying random stuff and pretending that it's true.
Yeah. And rereading this now, it hits me what terrible judgment it was for Josh to get back with her. Not just because she's Kia, but I feel like Edie would have every right to freak out over her co-creator dating the person claiming it was all her idea.
Yeah, Josh has made some very poor choices. Just like a certain other someone I could name, he makes poor choices Ooh. In regards to women.
Who do you mean? I don't
I'm
know
not naming names.
And Kia's theory about Anime is that it's Pez.
I love the reasoning that it's Pez because both Pez and Anime hit on her. I'm guessing they're not the only two guys to ever do that.
Well, no.
It's going to be a wide field.
Yeah, I think that she's saying that because Anime told her that they'd met.
Oh,
so she's
okay.
connecting that to Northgrove, which is yeah. correct. And then also connecting it to someone who's hit on her.
Oh, okay,
so
okay.
thinking it's Pez makes sense to me.
Yeah,
but it's
I
actually
guess so.
That strange guy outside of Northgrove.
Oh.
She talks about getting bad vibes from Northgrove and saying she was talking to someone strange outside. So that's actually Gus. That's
oh
why Enemy's saying that they met.
Oh, right. I didn't catch that. I totally believe it, though. It's a bit of a parallel to Tim mentioning Gus without knowing it was Gus in the last section, or at least that's
yeah.
what you think he was talking about, huh?
And then the interview takes a turn because this is where he opens up his documents and calls her out on sleeping with Wally Cardew.
Not the documents.
And then her own responses to the Pen of Justice post, and she starts to get angry and defensive.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to talk about the Pen of Justice actual posts again.
They're exhausting.
Yeah. My favorite bit of this is the line that says, "It isn't the cartoon, it's what it means," said Kia. "And who decides what it means?"
Well, obviously not the woman who created it, right? That's
no,
the
course.
Last person.
Should we go to chapter 50?
Yeah. So chapter 50, Robin chats with Paperwhite as Buffy paws while keeping an eye on Gus Upcott. And the epigraph for this one is, "Love, love, that art more strong than hate, more lasting and more full of art. Oh, blessed love, return, return, brighten the flame that needs must burn." And that is what Sappho would have said had her leap cured instead of killing her, by Christina Rossetti.
That is the longest title, I think, of any of the epigraphs.
Yes.
It's a pretty long title, yeah.
I hope you have something for this, because this one stumped me.
Yeah, this one, ostensibly, this would seem to apply to Paperwhite. Like, on the surface, mm-hmm. her wishing for Morehouse to forgive her and come back to her, right? Because
yeah.
the speaker in the poem, Sappho, wanders desolate for her lost love, eventually deciding to lie down and wait for it to come back to her. The tone of the poem is one of depression and exhaustion to me, which seems a bit at odds with Paperwhite's apparent active and persistent pursuit of Morehouse. So maybe that's what should clue us in, that she, quotation marks, Paperwhite, is not being completely honest, that contrast in tone with the poem. But it's a bit of a reach, because I feel like this epigraph is a red herring, and it's trying
yeah.
to fool the reader along with Paperwhite. And I suppose, too, that this mention of the poem of love being stronger than hate and more full of art is proven very wrong in this particular case in the book, because it is hate which is driving Gus's Paperwhite. Whatever love he might have had for Morehouse as a friend is nothing compared to the strength of his hatred and his bitterness, need for control and his schemes to protect himself and punish other people. Love is trampled underfoot under all that.
You saying that the epigraph is a red herring makes a lot of sense, because I couldn't find any real love in this chapter. Just so much hate.
Yeah.
That's what was really stumping me.
But yeah, I feel like on the first read through, this is like the red herring. Paperweight is sad. She wants Morehouse back.
Yeah.
Lies.
Chapter opens up. We're back with Robin. She's following Gus, which is especially interesting on a reread because we know he's the killer. And this is the first time I think we're seeing him under surveillance.
Is it the only time we see him under surveillance too?
Maybe.
In hindsight, the fact that Gus almost never emerges from his room should have been a giant neon sign pointing like, this guy is the internet troll. Like,
yeah, really.
Yeah.
He only leaves the house for his appointments.
Right.
She follows him to this restaurant, and there's this line here that says, if Seb Montgomery had never looked much like the popular image of the internet troll, Gus, for whom Robin couldn't help feeling rather sorry, perhaps conformed better to the stereotype. And the note I have in my ebook here is wondering if this is why she is less inclined to believe him as a suspect and keeps arguing against it, because she feels bad for him.
Yep.
And this is the thing that actually does make sense to me, because it's really understandable that she's looking at Kia because Kia is so unlikable, but she feels bad for Gus.
When was it in these books that Strike said that women's pity was bloody dangerous?
I don't remember.
I remember him saying that at some point, but for the life of me, I can't remember when. Women's pity or women's sympathy. Because I feel like Robin feeling sorry for Gus absolutely could have contributed to her not really believing he could be a suspect. Because he's pathetic. He's a bit sad. She feels badly for him in his situation. Oops.
It's the only thing that really makes sense to me, because we've been struggling with this.
I'm not sure if this is intentional, but I think I found kind of a fun little Easter egg type thing, since apparently this episode is all about birds. The restaurant that Gus goes to while Robin is following him, Fisher's, that's also the name of another kind of bird, which is also a parrot. Yeah, it's a Fisher's lovebird, which is a kind of parrot.
That's a great find, Kens.
I hit look up because, I just wanted to see whether or not it would pick any internet results. And I actually just wanted to look at the menu.
I was just thinking about food. Yeah, exactly.
I just wanted to see what they had to eat.
Yeah.
But yeah, then it was like, Fisher's lovebirds. Oh, that's a kind of parrot.
Nice.
So
I wonder if that's the same kind of lovebirds that Kia has.
Yeah, I don't know.
We'll never know. It never says, but that's interesting. Yeah. Maybe that's another connection with Gus and Kia.
Yeah, maybe.
I love Robin's response to Strike telling her that he managed to take a picture of Kia's internet history. She just goes, how the hell?
Don't leave your laptop unattended in a PI's presence either.
Yeah, but it's important because it says that Kia tried to log into the game that morning, which is weird, right? Do we know why she did that? Is she in the game?
I assume she plays the game on the download.
But she hates it. Well, maybe that's why she enjoys the Edie hate.
Oh, yeah. That seems very likely to me that she goes in and talks shit about Edie.
Yeah.
I was going to say, we don't know if it was a successful login or not, but I feel like she is a long-term game player just so that she can slag off Edie. And she was also looking to buy the t-shirt, which suggests to me that she probably is playing the game.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. Interesting. But we never get to find out what her character name is, do we?
No, we don't.
The real creator.
I love the point that Strike and Robin make about Paperwhite being allowed to have a pure character name in the game.
Yeah.
I feel like I really should have realized that Anemy was Paperwhite.
I should have seen it coming. This reread's making me feel very dense.
Yeah.
little bird brained. I'm not gonna lie. I'm like, the clues were there the whole goddamn time.
They always are.
Man, I love these books.
I know, I love them.
You know,
so much.
Me too. I kind of do too. Yeah.
They're so good.
Robin mentions Comic-Con and that they need to get costumes. I'm kind of bummed that Robin didn't also end up dressing up. I know we already talked about costumes, but if it's just the two of them, what is it going to be?
Ooh.
Is she going to go Star Wars too?
I feel like Robin could have been C-3PO. That could be a mask and he's gold.
I would have meant like a leather gold jumpsuit. I think Strike might have been into that.
If she was a sexy C-3PO, absolutely he'd have been into that. Are you kidding me? Yes, 100%. Or she could have been a sexy stormtrooper to go with his Darth Vader. I'm changing my answer to sexy stormtrooper.
Anything sexy.
Yeah, obviously. It's Comic-Con.
I'm surprised that she didn't throw out Chewbacca as like a joke suggestion.
Strike, you know, really should have dressed up as Chewbacca.
Because he's so hairy.
It's crazy that he didn't dress up as Chewbacca.
Anyway, going back to the chapter, one of my favorite things about this chapter is that Robin and Gus are sitting in the same restaurant. She's watching him and Paperwhite starts up a conversation.
Oh my God, it's amazing.
I think the most interesting thing is Paperwhite asking Buffy Paws if Anime talked to her on election night, because clearly Gus is trying to see how much he messed up.
Right. He's doing damage control.
Is he fishing because he doesn't remember what he said? Or is he also testing her to see if she is going to talk about it?
I think it might be both. I think if Robin had said anything suspicious happened, he might have blocked her then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think he would have too. Or tried to track her down and kill her.
Or that.
It would be awful if Beth got killed by him, because it was her email address.
Yeah. Paperwhite confesses all of this stuff to Robin / Buffy Paws about messing up with Morehouse and how she's in love with him. Do we know why Gus is doing this? What is his intention?
I think that he wants to keep Paperwhite's claws in Morehouse, right? He's So he's trying to use Buffy Paws as his little flying monkey here.
A messenger bird?
Yeah, a messenger bird, yes. But it's all part of his larger plan to keep Morehouse manipulated, to keep him on the hook.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because he tells her, if you talk to him, tell him.
Mm-hmm. He wants other people telling Morehouse how sad Paperwhite is.
When Paperwhite asks if Robin thinks it's possible to fall in love with someone you've never met, and Robin stops to think, please tell me I was not the only one dying for her to start thinking about Strike. I was dying for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Completely.
I want more thoughts about how in love she is with Strike.
Me too.
I want the running grave to be the running monologue of how much Robin and Strike are in love with each other.
The running monologue.
It'll put me in my grave.
Wow. But her actual thoughts are, it says, Robin stared at the question. She could imagine feeling an attraction, a connection, or a powerful desire to know someone better from an online meeting. But love? Love here in Drex game, where all that was possible was typing these messages to each other without even a photograph to feed the fantasy.
Mm.
So here's a question for you both. How would you answer this? Do you think it's possible?
I mean, he's all basically fallen in love with Strike, and he's a fictional character.
Okay, hold on. That wasn't the question.
I'm just saying maybe it's not that far-fetched, okay? But I think I'd have to agree with Robin, at least in regards to Drex game, because of those rules about sharing personal information.
Yeah.
How can you forge a real connection with someone without being able to share the most basic personal things about yourself?
I guess they could have secretly in private messages.
Oh yeah.
I think I'm a strong maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in Drex game it seems hard to get to know each other. But I guess I'm comparing it to friendships that I've made online, you know, because those are real friendships, people I care about.
Oh, 100%.
I saw a meme once that was so funny about online friendships. It said something like, I know everything about you, but I've never seen your legs.
That's why I love being friends with people online, because they can't see my legs.
Yeah, I'd say that I agree with that. Drex game, it seems like it would be difficult to forge a lot of real intimacy when you're talking about you can't share, like y'all were saying, the most basic parts of yourself.
Yeah,
I do think in general it's possible, you know, obviously for people who are talking online to fall in love and all of that fun stuff. I know people who met online, got married, and they're still very happily married and have been so for a long time. One of my best friends is somebody I met at a Harry Potter Facebook group when I was 15. Aww. So it's been like half my life and, you know, we've been friends.
Yeah.
So I think that outside of that, yes, definitely possible. But in Drex game, it seems a little bit less likely.
Yeah, I think that Anime, he poisons the well in Drex game. The atmosphere around him is such that I don't know if you can find real love in the platform he built.
It's also really clever how J.K. Rowling wrote this ending, because you'd think that if Paperwhite was the one to say she had to go as we're seeing Gus start to leave, that might have clicked. What I'm trying to say is that Robin being in pursuit of him, she's the one who left the conversation first in anticipation of following him.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? I almost wish she would have waited to see who left the game when Gus got up and walked away.
Yeah, because if Paperwhite stopped talking, Sack and Gus got up.
Yeah.
Robin might have come to the conclusion much sooner.
Yeah, it's a very narrow miss there.
I guess the book has to go on for another 50 chapters.
I guess it does, yeah.
Shall we move on to chapter 51?
Oh, yeah. Our two bonus chapters, the start of the very heavy episodes.
Yeah, this is a pretty short one, though.
Okay. Yeah. In chapter 51, Strike talks to Henry and his friend about Kosh, and then we also have Madeline's jewelry launch.
Yay.
Yeah, nothing I love more than a Madeline chapter.
So the epigraph, a wondrous thing to be so separate, having been so near. Near by hate last and once by so strong love. And that's Medea in Athens by Augustus Webster.
In this poem, Medea loathes Jason, her ex, who she blames for her killing her sons. I think it's pretty clearly referring to Strike meeting Charlotte.
Oh, yeah.
Charlotte clearly has not let go of Strike. But it's interesting to me that Strike appears to have moved on quite a bit from the intense feelings of love and anger that he used to have for her. She spends this whole conversation trying to goad him, but he actually seems pretty apathetic towards her. At least when you compare it to something like the scene in Lethal White, where he was suppressing his feelings about her during the whole conversation until they exploded in the restaurant. But here, she only gets a reaction once she drops something really outrageous, the bit about trying to get his sister to be her therapist. And I feel like his reaction to that was really more like just jaw-dropping disbelief at the audacity and nonsense rather than actually angry. I guess my point here is that it generally feels like a wondrous thing for us, the reader, that Strike really does seem so separate from Charlotte here when we've been experiencing the strength of his emotions for her over the course of like 4 or 5 previous books. She's really close to losing her power over him completely. And I think we see that here.
It must also be wondrous for him to have loved or thought he loved her so much and then to feel something close to hate, because it does seem like he genuinely dislikes her.
Yeah.
Even though that bond isn't broken completely yet.
Yeah.
And good for him.
Good for him, indeed. Yeah. He doesn't once mention that sort of longing that he always did in previous books.
Yeah, there's no virus in his blood.
He's just mildly annoyed and then baffled by her nonsense.
The chapter opens with Strike genuinely wishing that he could just go home instead of picking Madeline up from her launch. I think if I was him, I would have said, oh, I just got attacked by a bird. I really need stitches. Better be off to the hospital. You know, I'm bleeding really badly. Oh, no.
I got to go in A&E.
Yeah, I would have gotten the stitches just to get out of this.
Yeah, it would have been a viable excuse.
Can you even imagine him ever wanting to just go back to his attic rather than spending time with Robin? Like, never. In what situation would he not want to hang out with Robin instead?
Well, with Robin, she is home.
Yeah.
He won't ever have to make that choice. Plus, I mean, eventually home is going to be at the same place.
Robin, same thing. I'm just like, he needs to take a hint that Madeline, she ain't it.
I went back and looked at Strike and Madeline's previous conversation about the launch, and he asks her what time it'll be over, specifically saying that he only wants to come after. Yep. And she tells him 9 o'clock. I kind of feel like she knew people and photographers were still going to be lingering at this time.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
100. She was 100% setting this up so he would show up when everyone was still there. Mm-hmm. She refused to listen to his boundaries. She manipulated him and stomped all over them. I honestly have very little sympathy for her after she pulled this stunt. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm right there with you. This bit where Strike sees Henry and his friend smoking pot, he tells him that he won't tell on him and considers asking Henry to do the same thing and not tell Madeline that he's also hiding out.
Yeah.
It says, on balance, Strike decided this would be an unfair burden to lay on a teenager. And I just want to say, I think this is A+ parenting or being a responsible adult to not ask children to deal with adult situations.
Mm-hmm.
And especially keeping secrets from their parents.
Yes.
That's a big one. I just think it shows good judgment on his part.
I fully agree. Good job, Strike. I know that he doesn't want kids, but he'd make a real good dad.
I agree.
Real big dad energy there.
This is when Henry's friend starts talking all about Kosh. I like that it implies that Henry hasn't read it. And he's also kind of saying it's ridiculous, which gives me hope for him because I think he is a really nice kid.
Henry being unafraid to disagree with his friend to tell his friend that Kosh is full of shit is actually a really good sign for me. Because when you're a teenager, telling your friends, no, that's stupid, that's hard to do.
Yeah.
It gives me hope that he's a good kid and that he'll grow up into a good guy.
Although I'm kind of bummed that Strike is interrupted by the phone call from Flavia.
Yeah.
Because I really wanted to hear more of what he would have said to Henry's friend. Because it seemed like Henry's friend was kind of asking for advice. Like, this is right, right? This is how you pick up women. I'm just curious what his tips would be.
Strike's romance tips? Oh my God.
Yeah. What are Strike's romance tips?
So just sit there like a rough and stern and sexy giant. Do nothing. And unhinged women will throw themselves at you. Just exist.
Just be this.
Just be this. But buy some knee pads so when they turn and kick you, because those heels hurt. Also, if you fall in love with a woman who isn't a complete nut job, just push it deep down. Do nothing. Can't risk being happy.
But now we have this encounter with Charlotte, and I feel like she's 100% been trying to find him.
Oh, all night. Absolutely. And I feel like she was definitely pulling the strings with Madeline to get him there. Like, she was manipulating Madeline, playing on her insecurities so that she would get Strike to this launch.
Yeah. I don't know if I have much to say about the encounter with Charlotte. She's trying to pull him into conversation, but it's not really working. The thing that I think is most important is when she mentions wanting to go to Prudence for therapy because, quote, she's really good. Not just because, like you had said, not just because of the audacity, but this is another instance of therapy mentioned, and it feels significant because it's tied to Prudence.
Yeah, I'm really hoping this is some foreshadowing. But what you talk about, trying to pull him into conversation, I love that it's not working. Strike says to Charlotte at some point that she hasn't upset him. And you know what? I honestly believe that she hasn't. Because he doesn't care enough anymore for her to upset him. She's losing her hold on him, and I think that she knows it. But how funny was the teenage boy's reaction to seeing her, though? Complete speechlessness, jaw gaping. I bet that after that, they would have been begging Strike for his romance tips if they'd been able to. They'd be like, you pulled that? Oh my God, teach us your wisdom, senpai. Like... That just made me laugh. Teenage boys, they talk big, but then a beautiful woman shows up and they're like, oh my God.
I also think that Charlotte is very pleased that Madeline saw them standing in the dark together at the end of this chapter.
Yeah.
But I think what she's really pleased about is she knows that they're about to fight. Because as we learn in the next chapter, Charlotte dropped the Jago is using Strike in the divorce bomb in front of a bunch of people. And now Madeline's angry and Charlotte is loving it.
Yeah. Oh. She's really earning that Queen of Devils title here.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Chapter 52.
So, as we were talking about in the previous chapter, Strike and Madeline have their first big fight.
So, the epigraph to this chapter reads, I deck myself with silks and jewelry. I plume myself like any mated dove. They praise my wrestling show and never see my heart is breaking for a little love. And that is by Christina Rossetti. L-E-L.
I just realized there's another bird in this one. Dove.
Yeah, so this poem, it seems pretty clear and straightforward to me. The speaker is in misery because they're not loved when everyone else is. That's basically the whole poem. Wait. And it seems...
Sorry.
What was that?
I said, oh, man. Oh, Madeline.
Tiny's violin, yeah. But it seems pretty straightforwardly applicable here, too. Madeline wants Strike to love her. She's been manipulated by Charlotte into thinking, you know, he's a cheater, he's a user, etc. And she's hurt by that. Obviously, Charlotte is full of shit. But perhaps on some level, Madeline can sense that Strike's heart just isn't hers. It's never going to be hers, no matter how charming and beautiful and talented and rich and fancy clothes and fancy jewelry and fancy bars with no food she is.
Yeah.
But this might also be a clue that while she looks incredibly successful and powerful on the outside, there is a deep insecurity with Madeline.
I agree. I also thought that this epigraph was a little too sympathetic for her, and I don't feel much sympathy for her at all.
Yeah, no.
Is your heart breaking for a little love? Maybe don't act like a jealous, abusive person.
Right?
I guess the one place I could find the sympathy is I think that this epigraph could also apply to Lorelai.
Yes.
So more what you were saying about his heart not being in it. We've seen this pattern from him before. And it's got to be hard to be on the other end of it, which is also why I feel a little bit bad for Ryan Murphy.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'll get over that pretty quickly.
I think we'll manage. We'll put it in our
rearview
mirror.
I think we will. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe just women in general aren't going to have his heart. But for Madeline in particular, I'm having trouble with it.
Yeah. I don't feel very sympathetic to her at all in this chapter.
Let's just jump to the fight. I think this little touch that this giant portrait of Charlotte is watching them with a slight smile says so much that she has really caused this to happen.
Remember when he cleared out his stuff from her flat in Cuckoo's Calling and her giant portrait was looking down on him too?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like Charlotte's presence is almost supernatural in its ability to linger outside of her actual physical presence.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. And it also reminds me of the portrait of Charlotte that hangs in Robin's mind.
Yes.
In Troubled Blood.
Yeah, pictures of Charlotte hanging up everywhere. But in the end, Strike realized that Charlotte really is only portrait deep. He always thought there was something deeper to her than just that surface portrait. But no, there's not.
My immediate reaction is to say that I don't agree with anything Madeline says.
Yeah.
But I guess for the sake of fairness, let's go through it.
Sure. Yeah. Let's do it. Let's judge Judy this bench right here.
All right. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Lest we be accused of making excuses for him.
Yeah. Mm,
I have never been accused of that.
Never.
She accuses him of thinking he's Rokeby, which I think is a really low blow.
What?
Yeah. The fuck?
Yeah. First, she says he thinks he's Rokeby because he's worried about his photograph being taken. And then she says he thinks he's Rokeby because she accuses him of having women throw themselves at him.
Her accusations are so contradictory. And I love that he points that out. He's like, I don't want my picture taken. It's literally the opposite of Rokeby. I'm guessing she's just throwing this random shit out because Charlotte's convinced her he's lying about the whole picture thing. It's really that he just wants to keep Madeline a secret. Of course he wants the picture taken. You're his dirty secret or whatever.
Although I did love his line in regards to women throwing themselves at him when he says, nope, you were the first.
What a liar. Lies.
Well, I don't think he's lying. I think he's being sarcastic.
Well,
who cares? What does that even mean?
Right? That's his fault, I guess, that gorgeous women throw himself at him?
Yeah, and clearly she took it poorly, though, because as soon as he said it, she threw something at him.
Oh, yeah.
That was a big yikes.
Yikes.
My first reaction when he said that, no, you were the first, was like, oh, shit, he went there. Like, this is not going to go well. You just escalated that, buddy.
I don't blame him for that. He should have said it. Like, why does it matter?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, she does this. She picks up a jewelry box and throws it at him. But I noticed it talks about her aim being bad. And I think it says something really similar about Charlotte's later when she throws something at Jago. I don't know. It's just a connection to these two.
Yeah, it is.
We got Madeline, Charlotte, and Kia.
I know I mentioned birds of a feather earlier, and I'm going to reiterate that because this is a flock of
Of assholes.
A flock of nutters.
Anything. It's a flocking flock.
It's a flocking flock of flocked flockers. But that throwing that jewelry box, I can't believe that he didn't break up with her immediately.
Madeline is very angry at him for Jago naming him in his and Charlotte's divorce, which, as we discussed, I don't think is his fault.
Yeah, it's not. Really. And everyone's so mad at him for it. Poor Strike. I am completely sure that Charlotte has not only insinuated, but heavily hinted that she and Strike had an actual affair.
But Madeline's also angry that he didn't tell her about it.
When would he have gotten the chance in her, like, 40-minute monologues about how stressful her jewelry launch is?
I mean, okay.
Let him get a word edgewise. You know?
Yeah, I guess that's the only thing I can kind of give her, because having to pretend she knew in front of all those people, I could see why that would be embarrassing. And it also parallels a bit with Robin and emphasizes the thing about lying to the women in his life.
It does.
But I have been thinking more about this lately, about why Strike hasn't told anyone, especially Robin, more about these texts from Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
And we joked before that it would just be awkward.
I deleted it, I swear. There was no burgeoning.
None whatsoever.
Nothing burgeoned.
I think it would be difficult for him to have to try and explain why he hadn't changed his number earlier when I don't really think he can even understand that himself. It might be hard for him to look at and try and justify not being able to break that trauma bond that I don't even think he knows is a trauma bond. It's just not something he wants to examine or talk about. So I kind of understand why it was so hard for him to tell anybody.
I get it too, and I agree. And it makes me wonder if he feels not ashamed necessarily, but stupid or foolish for having let her keep that channel to him and then it biting him in the ass. I don't think he's stupid, but I'm wondering if he feels like...
Absolutely. We've talked about this before, about how people in abusive relationships often think, how could I have been so stupid? How could I have fallen for it? There is so much shame in that, even though it's not their fault.
Yeah, absolutely. Something else he can write down to talk about in therapy.
But yeah, it's just one of those things because, you know, we talk about, well, Robin's mad at him for him not telling, but I understand his motivations there, or what's maybe behind his inability to open up about it.
Yeah, I do too.
So this bit is really interesting when Madeline says that Strike doesn't want anyone to know he's with her, but she specifically mentions Robin because we can see that Charlotte absolutely recognized the shock in Robin's face.
Yeah.
I wish Strike would have thought about that more. I think he's so willing to dismiss everything Charlotte says because he knows what a liar she is, but she's not lying about that, is she?
Nope. I think that Charlotte will say anything that gets the reaction she wants. And sometimes the truth is more effective at getting that reaction.
Yeah.
Also, can I have a side note? Madeline calling her his darling Robin. Yeah. I mean, I know she's being sarcastic and mean about it, but she is his darling, okay? She is his darling Robin, 100%.
She is. It reminds me of when Lorelai said, oh, you wouldn't want to keep a Robin waiting.
Well, no.
It's like everyone can see it, even his girlfriends, that Robin is, you know, his priority, the one that he really loves.
Everyone can see it except for maybe certain kind of people on the internet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That takes.
You mean the type of people who think that Strike should actually be with Pat?
You can't feel the burgeoning chemistry between them, Lynn's?
What?
That's not the only one. There's a lot of bad takes online.
Yeah, that's one of the worst I've heard, personally.
I mean, honestly, I think a lot of these people are just trolling at this point.
Yeah, that has to be. That has to be a troll. No one can genuinely think that.
It's takes like this that make me really glad for J.K. Rowling's answer about never letting people influence her writing. Because...
Yeah.
So let's talk about this accusation Madeline throws out about Strike dating famous women. So she mentions Kiara and Ellen.
Yeah.
And I guess we could also throw Charlotte and maybe even herself in with this.
Yeah.
Four somewhat famous women does seem like a lot. So I honestly did try to give this thought. And he does have a weird relationship with fame where he loathes it, but in some ways it's part of him. So looking at each relationship, he met Charlotte at 19. I don't think that counts.
Nope.
Kiara, it was her fame that made him not pursue anything with her again. Doesn't count.
Yeah.
Ellen, he liked her because she wanted to keep it a secret.
Yep.
Doesn't count.
He met her at a party.
Yeah.
There was nothing about her fame there, right?
I bet he probably didn't even know who she was.
I would place bets that he did not. Yes.
And then Madeline, we all know why he's dating her.
Yeah.
In fact, his longest relationship was with Lorelai, who isn't even a little bit famous.
Yeah. So... And she was also the one he liked the most.
Yeah.
There is no substance to Madeline's accusation here. It's just a series of coincidences. And we know that Kiara and Madeline initiated things, and I'm guessing Ellen was pretty forward too. It's not like he's seeking out famous women. They literally just are drawn to him. It's not his fault.
Poor guy.
They're a series of badly wired lamps.
I mean, I'm glad you agree with me, and it's not just me wanting to defend him, but I really did try to think this through, but I just don't think that there's anything to this.
Yeah, me neither. Validation.
Thank you. And the thing that makes him walk away is when he tries to challenge this idea by asking how she squares that away with him not wanting to be photographed. And she says, maybe that just makes it easier for you to con the next rich woman into thinking you like her for herself.
Wow. Accusing him of being a gold digger now. Mm. He likes her because she looks like Robin. So I guess sort of likes her for herself. But not really, but definitely not. It's not for her money.
The implication about the money thing.
Like, citation needed.
He likes you for a shallow reason, but it's not because of your money. It's because of how you look.
Yeah, it's a different shallow reason.
Yeah. This actually makes me kind of angry because it makes me wonder what Charlotte was saying about money. That he didn't earn anything and lived with her.
Yep. And we know she harped on that in their relationship all the time, right?
So, God, what was she telling Madeline? Just, that makes me really defensive on his behalf. All kinds of
horrible things, I'm guessing.
But Madeline chases him outside, and this is where she falls face first, which I definitely think softens him to her because, I mean, he's not heartless.
Strike is not the kind of guy who's going to leave a drunk and possibly injured woman alone in the street at night. And then once he's picked her up, I guess it's easier for him to just accept her apology and sweep it under the rug, you know, rather than pick her up, help her, and then say, no, I'm breaking up with you.
Yeah.
That'd be awkward.
What do you think of her apology? Because it does not feel like it's genuine or that it's going to be okay. I think we all know it's not.
No. This gave me shades of Ellen in Career of Evil when she had that crying, throwing herself at Strike, saying, I'm sorry, I drank a bottle of wine alone when you stood me up. But then I'm sure that Madeline means all of it. She's clearly insecure about their relationship, and maybe she's picking up that he's not actually invested in it. But this isn't the way that you handle that. And this conflict was not solved in this argument. It was just swept under the rug.
Yeah.
Postponed.
Honestly, I believe that she believes what she said.
Yeah.
But this rang really hollow to me while I was reading it, because it was just one of those things, especially at the end of the chapter, Drake is reflecting back on Charlotte and whatnot. It just really made me think, this is not going to be the last time this is going to happen. They're going to have explosive arguments. She's going to cry and go, oh, I didn't mean any of it. And the cycle is just going to continue infinitely until one of them stops it.
Here is another moment where Strike kisses the top of Madeline's head. I knew there was another one and I couldn't remember where it was. And here it is.
I'm side-eyeing.
Yeah, and it's funny because we haven't mentioned yet that he's been texting with Robin throughout this argument. So she's kind of there with him.
And it's shades of her refusing to hang up on Strike when she's arguing with Matthew and Lethal White. She's like calling Strike right back.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah.
It's just interesting because Charlotte's just left, but the spirit of her lingers on, not only in the portrait hanging, but in the chaos that she's caused. But then you also have Robin texting him about the case, which to me almost feels like she's an anchor in reality, grounding him, keeping him a little bit sane.
Yeah, she so is.
Okay, so then he does call Robin back.
Good for him.
And he says, I've got to make a work call to Robin. That doesn't mean I'm shagging her.
Oh, Mars the pity.
Yeah.
Also, Strike, we all know that you want to.
Yeah.
We all know. We even know.
I want to jump to the end of the chapter real quick because something I think we should talk about is a thing that I've seen a lot of people talk about since the Ink Black Heart came out. Mm-hmm. And that's, why didn't Strike end this relationship here when it's so clear that it should be ended?
Yes.
And there's this line that says, this evening had brought back a tide of memories of life with Charlotte, of screams and thrown objects, outbursts of irrational jealousy, and accusations of every vice she'd met in her birth family. The difference had been that he'd loved Charlotte in spite of it all. Without love, such behavior held no appeal whatsoever for Strike. The rain continued to fall, and he smoked, leg aching, wishing himself 100 miles away from Bond Street. So I'm still sticking with my opinion that the purpose for Madeline is to break him down. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he's there yet.
Yeah.
That's part of the reason why he doesn't leave.
I think so too. He also, his character seems very reluctant to break up with women. When he's not happy with someone, he just starts avoiding her rather than actually breaking up, which always makes things so much worse. And I'm like, is this aversion caused by his experiences with Charlotte?
I really do wonder if Strike has a problem with ending relationships because, like you said, he either sticks around so much longer than he should, like with Charlotte or Lorelai, or he does something to piss them off and gets them to end it, like with Ellen.
Yeah.
And he thinks about, I need to end this, I need to end this, for so long, and he never does it. I just really wonder if it has anything to do with Leda always leaving, feeling like he can't walk away when it's bad.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think that could definitely be it. Plus, when you look at what happened when he was the one to leave Leda to go to Oxford.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I feel like that was a trauma.
Yeah. Oh man.
Well, he's not going to need to learn it because his next girlfriend's going to be Robin. He's never going to have to break up
in the universe
ever again.
You hear that, Joe? Mm-hmm. Never again.
I'm manifesting it.
Okay, I actually do believe this, though. I said this last time. I know I said this last time and that we were wrong. But this time...
Just keep saying it.
Yeah, I know. But this time I do believe it because she said it was a watershed moment for him. I really do.
Yeah, I really do as well. I genuinely think so as well.
Hoping.
Because I'm going to keep making the same predictions. And one day it's going to be true. Yeah. I'm not changing course.
No.
I think that it's really interesting getting to see a dynamic between Strike and his girlfriends that kind of mirrors what he had with Charlotte, you know, just because we never got to see that. We've gotten to see how he's hung out with his other girlfriends, but we've never got to see how he was with Charlotte. You kind of get to see how that might have gone while they were still together, where they have these explosive fights. She's throwing stuff. And then, like we were talking about earlier, she cries. She says, I didn't mean any of it, blah, blah, blah. And then the cycle just keeps on going. So I thought that was an interesting little, as far as the purpose.
Tidbit.
Yes.
At the same time, it is an interesting tidbit. At the same time, he is nowhere near as invested emotionally with Madeline. He doesn't care enough to fight back. Whereas with Charlotte, I think she also brought out a lot of fighting back in him.
100%.
Because we see him more angry and more explosive when Charlotte shows up at the office than we do here.
Yeah.
Another thing that we've seen Strike say is that he believes that love is pain. Mm-hmm. So if he's telling himself that he really has to try and give this a real chance, that's what he thinks it is.
Stop. My heart can't handle it.
What is that quote?
Oh, man. An excuse to read one of my favorite parts of Lethal White. I think I'll take it.
Okay.
All right. So, God, I love this part so much.
It's so good.
It's my favorite. I screamed the first time that I read this. I was like, Oh, yeah, same. I know what this means. Strike had made a vow to himself 2 years previously, and he made very few vows because he trusted himself to keep them. Having never said, I love you, to any woman but Charlotte, he would not say it to another unless he knew, beyond reasonable doubt, that he wanted to stay with that woman and make a life with her. It would make a mockery of what he'd been through with Charlotte if he said it under circumstances any less serious. Only love could have justified the havoc they had lived together, or the many times he had resumed the relationship, even while he knew in his soul that it couldn't work. Love, to Strike, was pain and grief sought, accepted, endured.
God.
Thanks for making me cry today.
I'm just thinking again how we're coming up to the final four books and that we're going to see this resolve.
We're going to see it.
Not just say it, but know that Charlotte was...
He's going to be like, I shouldn't have ever said it to Charlotte. I should have saved it for Robin.
You know, this quote from Lethal White, it just makes me wonder if Strike is going to like come to this realization where he realizes that what he had with Charlotte was making a mockery of love and not, what he has with Robin.
Yes, that's what I mean. Yes. We're going to see this resolved. It's going to be so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be gorgeous. There's going to be a moment. He's going to look at her and be like, holy shit. I've never actually been in love before.
Yeah, that's what I want too.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
This is what love is? Oh my god.
God. No, forget it all. He's going to be with Pat. All of this. All of this
building up.
All of this sucking on their vapes.
Yeah, this is what love is.
Vapes all of this foreshadowing means nothing, guys. Come on.
Okay. Thank you.
We can't end the chapter without going back and mentioning his call to Robin, because she tells him about the fight Zoe and Hartella had, where Zoe told her all about believing that Hartella and Annemie are working on something together. And so Strike and Robin are making the plan to interview Yasmin, just like they did with Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile. And I bet you are so excited, Pools.
Is it too late to fake my own death?
Yeah. I don't think you can make that announcement and then do it.
Okay.
Lost the element of surprise there, Pools.
I guess that I better brace myself and get a lot of whiskey in for the next episode, because...
Is it the next one?
Yeah, it is.
Tell us, Kens, what we're doing in the next episode besides...
Suffering.
Endless suffering.
Suffering. That's what we're doing.
So in the next episode, we're covering chapters 53 through 57. And in these chapters, Strike and Robin go to Comic-Con, Robin interviews Yasmin, and Vile Petura is pushed onto the train tracks.
Good for him.
I realize that in our next episode, we're going to be hitting the halfway mark.
What?
Which is incredible. Oh,
so halfway of 107 is 53 and a half. So we're going to get there.
Wow.
Next time.
You know what's even better in the episode after that? I'm pretty sure that that's when Robin moves into her new flat, right?
Oh, thank God. Aww. Is it? We haven't had shippy shit in so long. We need it. We're going to need it after next episode.
Oh, I love that.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.